I'm happy to welcome Jennifer Chavarini back to Around Cincinnati. Many of us know her well from her best-selling Elm Creek quilt series, along with the companion quilt fabrics she designs. Tonight, she's in the studio to talk with me about her latest novel, which takes her in something of a new direction in that it's an historical novel, and it is titled Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. Jennifer, good to see you.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thank you.
As the title, Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker, implies, your book takes place mainly in Washington, D.C., and it begins and goes into the Civil War years. Tell us what Mrs. Lincoln's dressmaker, who was Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, what was her life like before she came to Washington? How did she get there? How did she survive?
Well, Elizabeth Keckley was born into slavery in Virginia in 1818, and she remained within the same extended family for about 38 years, sometimes living in Virginia, sometimes being lent to another member of the family and working in a household in North Carolina. But then she made her way to St. Louis with the Hugh Garland family. And Hugh Garland was a lawyer, and he actually worked on the Dred Scott case in St. Louis. Elizabeth was very, very talented as a dressmaker. She learned by making dresses not only for the slaves within the household, but also for the young ladies of the household who were her half-sisters and her nieces. She was hired out in St. Louis, which meant that she would take on dressmaking duties for other residents of St. Louis, but of course all of her earnings would go to the Garland family. And as Elizabeth was going about the city, I'm sure this was a yearning she had throughout her life, she became more and more determined to become like many of the other African-American women she saw in the city, a free and independent woman on her own. And she wanted very much to buy her freedom and buy that of her son. So repeatedly she would go to Mr. Garland and ask what was the price, what would she have to pay for her and her son to be free, and he would repeatedly rebuff her. He often demanded that she never ask again, but she would not let go. Eventually he settled on the price of $1,200. It was an enormous sum, especially considering that she was probably earning about $3 a day. That was when she wasn't making money just for the household that she was obliged to as a slave within the household. So it would have been very, very difficult for her to come up with this money on her own. The closer she came to despondency and giving, she never came close to giving up, but the harder it seemed that it would be for her to achieve this goal, the more her loyal customers of St. Louis decided to rally to her side. Among them, they accumulated the money that she would need to pay off that sum. They raised the whole $1,200. And Elizabeth bought her freedom and her son's. After that, she was able to earn her own living. She never considered that money more than a loan, so she paid them back. And then she placed her son in college. A formal education was something she had long desired for herself, but it was a dream she could not fulfill. So she was determined to see that her son was educated. And then she left St. Louis behind and made her way first to Baltimore and then to Washington, D.C., where she worked as an assistant seamstress for a little while, but very soon set up her own business. She was quite an entrepreneur, and she set out her own mantua-making business. Before long, after making one lady of the Washington social elite very happy and earning her recommendation to all of her friends, Elizabeth Keckley was able to establish an excellent reputation, and she became the most desired dressmaker of the most fashionable ladies of Washington.
Hence came into the president's wife's life for some many years. Interesting side note, George, Elizabeth's son, went to Wilberforce in Ohio.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So Elizabeth Keckley has Ohio connections.
Yes, not far from here. There is a lovely exchange that I want to ask you to read about. Mrs. Lincoln has been pestering President Lincoln to fire Salmon P. Chase, another Cincinnati figure from a long time ago, who is very much a part of the team of rivals that Lincoln is known to have assembled and who is working against Lincoln, shall we say, in some ways. So if you would read about this very sweet and equitable exchange between Elizabeth and Abraham Lincoln.
After a moment, the president sighed and settled down wearily in his easy chair. "Well, Madam Elizabeth," he asked, his voice hoarse and tired, "will you brush my bristles down today?" "Certainly, Mr. President." Taking up his comb and brush, Elizabeth dressed his hair, arranging it as neatly as she could. Mr. Lincoln sat in glum, brooding silence while she worked, until suddenly his mouth curved in a faint smile, and he said, "Madam Elizabeth, you have lived on a farm, have you not?" "Yes, Mr. President," she said, "when I was a child in Virginia." "Then you know what a chinfly is." Elizabeth smiled. "Sadly, sir, I am acquainted with the pesky species. When I was a boy, my brother and I were once plowing corn, I driving the horse and he holding the plow," Mr. Lincoln reminisced. "The horse was lazy, but on one occasion he rushed across the field so that I could scarcely keep pace with him, running as fast as I could. On reaching the end of the furrow, I found an enormous chinfly fastened upon him, and so I swatted it off. My brother asked me why I did it. I told him I didn't want the poor old horse bitten in that way. 'But, Abe,' said my brother, 'that's all that made him go.'" Elizabeth laughed. "Now, Madam Elizabeth," said Mr. Lincoln, more cheerful than she had yet seen him that day, "if Mr. Chase has a presidential chin fly biting him, I'm not going to swat it off, just in case that is what makes the Department of the Treasury go." Elizabeth considered. "Sometimes a chin fly can become such a nuisance that the horse flicks its tail and cranes its neck trying to bite it, and is so busy trying to get at it that he forgets to plow." Mr. Lincoln frowned thoughtfully. "I suppose in that case it would be right to swat that chin fly without delay. The trick is knowing when the chin fly goes from being a help to a hindrance." "It's good that you know how to properly deal with chin flies," said Elizabeth pertly, and she was rewarded with the president's laugh. On the other side of the room, Mrs. Lincoln gave a loud, drawn-out, exasperated sigh.
Elizabeth is a self-supporting, single woman. She's also very engaged in charitable work. Some of that had to do with teaching other slaves to sew, helping them make a way to freedom and to being self-sufficient. She's also involved with the Contraband Relief Association. Tell us what that was.
Elizabeth was very well established in Washington at that point, and she had Mrs. Lincoln as one of her patrons, but she also had a very full and rich life with her friends and with her church and other customers as well. After a few years of the war, Washington was inundated with newly freed slaves trying to build new lives for themselves. They came to Washington seeking to escape the plantations where they had been living, and they were absolutely unprepared for lives as free citizens because of the conditions in which they had been living so far. And they came to Washington and they lived in squalid camps, or they built shacks for themselves in alleyways. Elizabeth was very moved by their plight. She knew what it was to be a slave, and she knew what it was to have freedom, but she had hired out so often and had moved independently about Petersburg, Virginia first, then St. Louis. She had had time to acquire necessary skills before she was suddenly free and independent. She saw thousands of men, women, and children who did not have that opportunity to properly prepare themselves. She decided to organize the prosperous African-American community already organized in Washington to solicit donations for the Contraband Relief Association, which not only provided for the refugees' immediate necessary needs, such as housing and food and clothing, but it also invested in their long-term survival by giving them necessary skills, such as learning how to seek employment, how to negotiate a wage, and something that was quite a revelation, how to leave an employer that was not treating you fairly, because these were skills and knowledge that they did not yet have. And Elizabeth, as you said, also helped teach sewing, literacy, and other important skills there too, primarily focusing on the women as far as teaching sewing went. I think that this really shows that Elizabeth's legacy must have been profound, although we can certainly never quantify it, because for every person that she helped in the refugee camps, that person was able to go on and not only build a better life for themselves, but also for their families. So it must have had long-lasting, long-reaching effects that she undertook in all modesty and out of pure compassion. And I should say that Mary Lincoln was one of her strongest supporters in this endeavor. She was one of the first donors to the association.
You see the rippling effects going out.
Absolutely.
And one of the ripple effects I want to thank you for is bringing Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley to life for us, because I certainly didn't know about her. She would be lost in the pages of history. And I think it's also important for listeners to know that Elizabeth herself did write a book, and that certainly had to be the bedrock of your research, I'm guessing.
Right. It absolutely was the foundation. And if Robert Lincoln, the Lincoln's eldest son, had had his way, Elizabeth Keckley and her memoir in particular would have been lost to the pages of history. These days, we expect almost anyone with any brush with fame or celebrity to write a tell-all book. And that was certainly not what Elizabeth intended to write, but that was how it was received. And in those days, it was quite scandalous. Elizabeth wanted to write her own story. She wanted to write this memoir, which was published as Behind the Scenes, in part because she had lived such a fascinating, amazing life that many of her friends and acquaintances told her that she ought to write her life story and share it. But she also wanted to try to, as she said, put Mary Lincoln in a better light before the world. She was often very indignant that, especially in the press and in the social elite circles in Washington, D.C., Mary Lincoln was never given enough credit for the good that she did, and she was always given tremendous criticism for any misstep, any misspoken word, any misguided action. And she thought that if people understood what went behind all of those decisions that Mary Lincoln made, if they understood her good intentions and her well-meaning motivations, they would have more compassion for her. They would have a better understanding of the woman she really was. And so she wrote this memoir not only to account for her own years in slavery and her own rise to being an intimate of the White House, but also to provide a better picture of Mary Lincoln. Unfortunately, Mary Lincoln considered that a great betrayal. And it was true that Elizabeth Keckley did not sanitize her version of truth. She said in the introduction to her book, she was compelled to tell the truth for good and for ill, and she thought that in balance, people would see it as a very fair and redeeming portrait. But Mary Lincoln saw anything of this sort as a betrayal, and it upset her so greatly that she severed ties with the woman she had once called her best and dearest friend.
Well, and I think it was certainly an honest portrait of Mary, as is yours of Elizabeth. Thank you so much. Just a fascinating story. Thanks for being with us tonight.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking with Jennifer Chiaverini about her latest book, Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. You'll find more information at wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Barbara Gray.